Birds are such a wonder to watch and to listen to. Even if you're just listening to what's around you when you're out running errands or working in the garden, there's so much to take in. But how do we know what we're hearing? As is the case for most holidays, we have two expert and passionate bird watchers with us to share their love and knowledge of birds. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Glad you could spend your holiday with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Noel Cutright is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, thanks so much for spending your holiday with us.
Always enjoy these occasions, Judith, and welcome, and hope everyone out there listening today has a great 4th of July holiday.
Well, at least down here in Madison, it's about picture-perfect weather. I hope the rest of the state is enjoying it, too. And Bill Volkert has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years, 27 of those he spent as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. Bill, always a pleasure to have you with us as well.
Well, thanks, Judith, and it's such a pleasure to be back again with you.
Well, we do these birding shows on pretty much every major holiday, and the summer is a lot of fun because we get to do Memorial Day, and then not too much later we do 4th of July, and then, of course, Labor Day as well. And it's good that we do because there's so much going on with our birds. And so one thing that's certainly different this year than when we were talking last year having been so hot and so dry, this year it's the opposite. It's been a cool, wet spring, and now early summer, too. How has that affected the birds, Bill?
Well, as we noticed in spring, we had a late and delayed migration, so a lot of the birds were slow to get here. The cool weather persisted, and it basically pushed that schedule or that timetable back. They're not only late to get here, a lot of them were late to initiate nesting, and as a result, they're a little slow to get some of the young out of the nest. I noticed for Canada geese, which are very common and widespread nesters these days around the state, usually it was the last week of April that we started seeing the first good nest hatching of the young. We were well into the first 10 days of May before we started seeing really the majority of them starting to come out, and even into mid-late May, we still saw broods hatching out. So, yeah, that timetable was pushed back. But, you know, they're making up for lost time now, and if you take a look at where we're at, for those birds that may raise more than one brood, they're getting the young out. Say bluebirds, for example, they may raise a second brood, and there's plenty of time to raise another family. I've had phoebes. The young jumped out of the nest about 2 weeks ago, and I'm sure, like last year, there's plenty of time for them to start another family yet before summer's gone.
And Noel, what have you been seeing as far as birds being a little behind schedule?
Well, I've seen the same thing as Bill and others that are early watching our birds are seeing here in the state. You know, there's birds still building. I saw barn swallows last week, you know, still collecting mud for their nests. So it's definitely is delayed this year. And, of course, that gives us an opportunity to watch breeding birds later in the year this year compared to last year.
So in general, in say, an average summer, which I'm not sure any of us really remember what average is anymore, but in an average summer, Noel, how long does it take birds to build their nests, and does it matter on what kind of bird it is?
Yeah, it really varies a lot. In the springtime, things tend to be a little bit leisurely, and they'll take a break if we have a spell of cold and wet weather. You know, this time of year, with the long daylight we have during the daylight period, birds can really jump to it and build a nest pretty quickly. But it does vary from bird to bird, but some can just build them in a couple of days. It didn't take very long. Now, others will take maybe a couple of weeks before they complete their nest.
And Bill, Noel was saying that he was seeing swallows still gathering mud. What other materials are most often used in these nests?
Well, for nest identification, especially the cup nests, the main thing we look for there for identifying is the size of the nest, how big across it is, how high it is or low in a tree, shrub, or on the ground, and what it's built on the outside and then the inside lining. So something like, say, chipping sparrows will weave grasses around the outside and usually using animal hair for a lining on the inside. Robins, of course, everybody knows they'll use the mud as the foundation and then the grasses as the lining of it. When we have the tree cavity nesting birds, they're relying on either natural cavities that were drilled out by woodpeckers in a previous year or naturally rotted holes in trees, or, of course, the nest boxes. And anybody who monitors nest boxes knows that we can tell what birds are using them by the material. So fine little twigs and sticks for wrens, grasses always lined with feathers for tree swallows, and then the lining of just fine grasses for bluebirds. So they all use different material, but there's usually something as an outer structure to give it some strength and support and adhere it to a branch or get it firmly underground, and then a nice lining, both for reflecting that heat and keeping the warmth in it, and kind of a soft area for the young to hatch out and develop in.
I was at a garden center the other day, and I think it was the first time that I've seen this. I saw actual packages being sold of nesting material that you could put out, I'm assuming near feeders and things like that, so that birds could find it. Do they need that, or, you know, are they able to find what they need on their own? What do you think, Noel?
I don't think they need it. There are certainly plenty of materials out there. When we comb our golden retriever, we leave the hair out. So you'll see birds coming and collecting that, and as Bill says, some will use the hair of either our wild animals or maybe our domesticated animals like horses and cows. And, of course, some species like our tree swallow like to line their nests with feathers. I know that some people like to gather their chicken feathers or whatever and put them out. So this is something I think to kind of bring birds closer to you, and you can watch them taking the material, and I guess it gives you a good feel inside, but they certainly have enough out there. And there are some good, you know, people want to identify their nest. There are some good field guides out there in the Peterson series. There's a Peterson field guide to Eastern Birds Nests. So there are definitely some guidebooks that you can buy if you really want to get into nest identification.
We did a show probably last year now on a book called Avian Architecture. And for people that are interested in nests, it's really fascinating looking at the different techniques that birds use around the world. So not just our North American species, but some really incredibly intricate and elaborate nests.
And the architecture even here in Wisconsin varies a lot, from birds laying their eggs right on the forest floor with no nest at all to maybe just a shallow depression. And, of course, we always marvel at how little a mourning dove puts together for a nest. Hmm. You just gather a few sticks and kind of crisscross them a little bit, and it's amazing the storms they can withstand. And, of course, mourning doves are very productive. So whatever works for a particular species, that's what they do.
So the mourning doves are the minimalists of the nest-building world.
Pretty much so.
So what's the usual incubation period for eggs, Bill?
That, again, depends entirely, and it's usually depends on the size of the bird, size of the egg. On the low end, we might have something like a house wren that is barely 10 days. I think it's 9 to 11 days is most of the observations, which to me is incredibly fast. Canada goose, turkeys, they're up there around 28, 29 days. So we're looking at anywhere from, say, a week and a half to a month's time. Now, what also happens is incubation for the vast majority of birds, there are just a few exceptions, it doesn't begin until all the eggs are laid. So in other words, the birds will construct the nest, a mating will take place, and then the female will lay an egg every day or every 2 days until she has a clutch complete. And that may be as few as two eggs, or in the case of ducks, it may be up to a dozen or more. Then she begins to incubate them. That way, all those eggs begin to develop and eventually hatch at the same time. So that way, everybody's in sequence, or in sync there, and all the young are hatching out the same day. They're getting ready to fledge. It's a lot easier to manage a family. The exception to that rule is owls, and that's because owls will start the nest in winter. We've got great horned owls that have been seen on the nest in January, February, not exceptionally, but commonly. Well, you can't lay an egg and then wait for a day or two, lay another egg, the first one will be frozen solid. So they begin to incubate immediately, which means they all hatch out on different days, and you get kind of brother-sister from the little one up to the bigger one. And they're all different sizes, and unfortunately, I guess from our point of view, if there's not enough food to go around, the bigger ones will even kill and eat the young ones. Mm. And that's one of the unusual exceptions. But, again, it goes from a week and a half to a month, roughly, for incubation. And then we also have two different trends of raising the young from the scientific terminology, what we call precocial or altricial young. Real simply, what we mean, precocial young are those that the day they hatch out, they're fully feathered, they fluff up, dry off, and they leave the nest right there. So in other words, they're quite developed when they hatch out. good examples for those are the turkeys, the pheasants, the grouse, that family, the geese, ducks. Those are birds that have the precocial young. The more common ones are the songbirds, the altricial young. They hatch out basically prematurely. They're naked, they're blind, and they have to now have another period of developing in the nest. And that period is usually equal to or pretty close to the incubation time. So half the time is in the egg, half the time is developing as a very tiny chick into a full fledgling, and then they can jump the nest. That's when now the parents will feed them out of the nest. It's a little safer. Care for them for probably two and a half, 3 weeks. They'll keep begging for a while, and then eventually they'll get them to be independent, and if there's enough time, they may start a second family for the summer.
Bill had a really interesting experience this year, Judith, where he saw two different species fledging out of the same nest box. So,
yes, and we actually have photos of that up on the Facebook page, and I definitely want to talk about that. But first, since we're still in the egg stage, I want to point out that Bill sent a photo to me that I put up on the Facebook page of a mallard's nest that is near a golf course, and some of those eggs are never going to hatch, are they, Bill, because they're actually golf balls?
Yes. It was an unusual picture. It was actually from Fond du Lac during their walleye weekend. And this was by the city park. It actually wasn't a golf course, but I think there was some sort of a golf, kind of a game tournament or something of it. People were whacking the golf balls down in a sort of an open area. Turns out that where the balls were going astray was right near a mallard nest. And if somebody took a closer look after the event, the mallard nest had about a half a dozen eggs in it and four of these marked golf balls. They sent the photos to me and said, what the heck is going on? The best I could guess on this is the balls were very close to the nest. And as I explained for an article for them, and I think that must be on your Facebook page as well, birds have to turn those eggs every day. And we learned this, actually, from artificial incubation of eggs. We can take eggs, keep them at a nice warm temperature, put them in an incubator, and hatch them out artificially. That's done for, say, pheasants at the Poinette Game Farm and certainly with poultry. Turns out, though, those eggs have to be turned and rolled because that's what the female does. The developing embryo is actually floating inside of that egg, and if you don't keep turning it, it's not so much that you don't get equal heat distribution, but the young starts to develop sort of leaning on a foot, a wing, or part of a body part, and it may actually, from its own increasing weight, become deformed. So the female turns those eggs. Well, for ducks that nest on the ground, those eggs, as they get turned, may sometimes, I'm guessing, roll out of the nest, and she has a habit of bringing them back. Well, here were golf balls nearby, and I guess instinct said, well, bring those back into the nest, and she just kept bringing these golf balls in and trying to incubate those as well.
Wow.
Now, the one concern, of course, is that is this now going to keep her sitting on those eggs indefinitely until she waits and waits and waits till the golf balls hatch out and never will? No, because in a clutch of eggs, it's not uncommon to have infertile eggs or addled eggs. In other words, something that is just not going to hatch. And so what the female does is she waits for everybody to hatch, or, you know, most of them anyways, and then once they're all fluffed up and dried off, walks away with whatever she can. In other words, she's not trying to care for every last egg and every single young, but maximum survival, most of them that she can raise.
Well, it's a fascinating picture, and I have to say, unless you know what you're looking at, it would be easy to just assume that they were all eggs. They're close enough in size and color, although, as you said, that the golf balls have bands of color around them. But you should check those out on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mealer today, talking about birds with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Noel is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill is a naturalist and a retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also leave a question, comment, or a bird photo on our Facebook page. Stay tuned, more after this break. Coming up at 11, or I'm sorry, at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn is in her new time slot, and she has a wonderful rebroadcast of an interview with former Senator from Maine, Olympia Snow. That's at 1 o'clock today. Right now, we are talking about birds, bird watching, and bird listening with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. And we do have a couple of things up on the Facebook page that Bill had noticed earlier, and we definitely want to talk about. We have a photo and from Mike, and he says, what's up with this male cardinal? Is he, quote-unquote, henpecked by another, the dominant male? The photo was in May, and my friend saw him again recently. Not much changed. And it's a cardinal, I think, but his entire head is bald. What's going on there, Bill?
I had this reported several times over the past few years from listeners. It is probably the most common of the bird species in Wisconsin to be seen with this condition, and it seems to be the loss of feathers around the head. Not a real good explanation for this. It may be related to some sort of a skin infection, feather mites, or something of the sort. We're not sure, or there may be actually multiple causes. And it also seems that some birds are more susceptible to this than others. Just in general, it's some sort of an unusual condition as a feather loss. They will grow back, and usually it's not a big problem. It's kind of like, say, what mange is in mammals, resulting in a hair loss. It's probably uncomfortable conditions, inconvenient, and maybe a little hard to attract a mate if you're looking quite like that, awful scraggly.
Well, but you know, they do say bald is in, though.
Yeah, well, maybe for us, you know, but it doesn't really work for cardinals, I don't think. Really what we have is it's not an overall problem for the bird unless it occurs in wintertime, because the feathers are essential for insulation for our cold winters. But cardinals are probably the most likely seen, and there's probably more than one explanation for this. The most common one I hear of is feather mites, but I don't think it's conclusive that that is always the case. But yeah, it's not unusual to see birds with that sort of feather loss, and it happens in a few other species.
And then Kathy on Facebook had a question about tree swallows. She said they arrive regularly up in Superior, where she is, every year around April 19th. But this year, as she recalls, they had a big snowstorm around that date. Not only did the tree swallows not return to her yard, but there are none to be found anywhere within at least 3 miles of her home, even down by the water where people have put out nest boxes for them. Could they have all been killed or just diverted by the storm, and what are the chances of them returning next spring? What do you think, Noel?
I think there's a good chance they'll be back. You know, every year we see differences in local abundance and local presence. You know, we hear it during the winter time when, why don't I have a certain species in my feeder? They're here every year. It's hard to explain some of these changes or what causes them, whether it's food supply, whether it's weather, what it might be, but usually these are just short-term differences. Of course, if we start seeing this over and over and over again over a broader geographical range, then we start becoming concerned that, you know, it's going to have an effect on the overall population. That's one of the reasons why this time of year we're involved in doing a lot of breeding bird surveys to try to keep track of what populations are doing, whether they're increasing, decreasing, or more or less stable. And only over a long period of time can you determine this, a year-to-year fluctuation. Typically, it's not a big thing for bird populations to deal with.
And we're definitely going to talk about those breeding bird surveys a little later in the show, but I want to get to the phone since we have some folks that are waiting to join in. And Jilly and Amory is up first. Hi, Jilly.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Good day, all. Gentlemen, a challenge, though methinks not much of a one for you. The Martin House vacancy sign blinking. Darn, and we've had that conversation before. The vacancy sign blinking, a lovely pair of birds, yay, a lovely pair of birds now occupy a compartment. We're not familiar with these birds, and the bird is neither in the Birds of Wisconsin or the Birds of Minnesota book, which may be the same book, I'm not sure. At Half Price Books, I purchased a Reader's Digest book of North American birds, and there she blows. Okay, this bird is 8 to 9 inches, cinnamon wings, lemon, soft yellow belly, and to top it off, a mood-denoting crest. Gentlemen, name that bird.
All right. What do you think that might be, Bill?
I was hoping probably going to ask for Noel first.
Oh, Noel, what do you think that might be?
I don't have the slightest idea.
Well, it is the great crested flycatcher.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great crested. Oh, sure.
And what can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, it is a crested nester. And he's got that gray throat with yellow in more into the belly, where most birds have bright colors up in the throat. So they do use old cavities, and they have an unusual habit. We talked about nest construction and nest material earlier. The vast majority of them bring shed snake skins into the nest.
Wow.
And sometimes you'll see them hanging out from the edge of it. We're not sure why, if that's to fend off possible predators or maybe they just like it. What I'm always fascinated with is, for me, it's an unusual case to actually find a shed snake skin. These guys seem to have the ability to find them on a very regular basis and incorporate it into the nesting material and do so by habit.
Wow. So they're using it as nesting material. They're not...
Well, it's not actually, say, a nest lining, but they somehow incorporate it into the nest, and sometimes you'll see it hanging out of the edge of the nest, and we're not sure why. I've seen this before. I've discovered a few of their nests, and sure enough, I've seen that just as the literature indicates.
Wow. Now,
great cresteds are our only flycatcher that nest in cavities, so it is somewhat unique. And it does nest in every county in Wisconsin. And we talked about nest building earlier. Sometimes it may take 2 weeks for a great crested to build a nest. And while they use natural cavities in dead or living trees as preferred sites, they found them in woodpecker holes and nest boxes and posts and pipes and buckets and cans. I once found one in an old mailing tube of a newspaper. So you can find them in a lot of different places. And they're really neat birds to have because they have neat vocalizations. It's fun to watch them out there, catching insects, especially when they get young in the nest, and transporting the insects that they catch in flight into their young.
Wow, well, thanks for that call, Jilly, and we would love to see a picture if you can get one taken. You can always email that to talk@wpr.org or put it up on our Facebook page. Irving and Burnett would like to talk about nesting as well, so let's go there. Hi, Irving.
Hello there.
Hi.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment on nesting material. Years ago when the kids had horses here, well, that was the first time I ever saw orioles that would nest. Of course, they picked up the horsehair, et cetera, or caught the fence lines and on the ground. But after the kids were gone and the horses were gone, I started hanging up crochet cotton in about 12-inch lengths. And this year I know I have four nesting pairs of orioles, and I could hang up like a dozen or 20 pieces of crochet cotton out on the fence lines, and I wouldn't get back to the house and the orioles would already be there picking them all off.
Wow.
And their nests from the crochet cotton from last year, of course, are still hanging. They don't rot out real fast. So after the orioles were done nesting, all of a sudden I happened to notice that the cedar waxwings, they also enjoyed crochet cotton. And I think I have three pair of those this year.
Wonderful.
So nesting materials are quite important to them. And with less and less cattle and horses around, they have a short supply.
Well, thanks for that call, Irving. And you were saying earlier, Noel, that they probably don't need it, but on the other hand, maybe they appreciate it.
Sure. It's less energy. If they have a reliable source of place where they can go, they'll just keep revisiting that site. And it reduces the amount of time and energy that it takes for searching for suitable natural nesting. So I didn't mean to discourage people putting things out, but... If they're not there, obviously they're going to find enough natural materials to build it. But it's kind of fun, especially if you get different colors, and you can see some of those different colors incorporated into a nest.
I was going to mention the same thing. I know people have done that with strips of yarn for nesting orioles. And at the end of the year when the leaves come down, they get this multicolored woven nest hanging up there.
Wow.
Looks like a piece of artwork.
Well, thanks for that call, Irving. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about birds with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, as we do on many holidays. And let's go next to Tom in Stoddard. Hi, Tom.
Yes, thank you guys for sharing your holidays with us. I wanted to mention on a follow-up on the cardinal without a topknot on top of his head, a crest on top of his head. 40 years ago when I was in college, I was walking along the road, and I found a cardinal that had been scalped down to the dry bone. And I caught him and brought him home and overwintered him, put him first in an 1 gallon ice cream box with some food until I could build a cage, and that was great because it confined him in a real small area so he didn't beat himself against some caging and cause himself more damage. But by springtime, that had all healed over amazingly. That dry bone somehow regenerated a skin. I suppose it came in from the side. But he had a full head of hair on top, but he did not have a crest on top anymore.
Oh, interesting. Well, thanks for that observation. Going back to that photo that we saw, Noel, it sounds like at least some birds are able to recover from some pretty serious injuries.
Yeah, the recuperative ability of birds and, you know, animals in general. You look at human beings, what we can put up with and get through at times. Living creatures have an amazing way of recuperating and regenerating and surviving some really pretty horrible ordeals.
We've been talking about birds nesting and that this is, many of them have made their nests or are finishing up their nests and now are raising their young. But, Bill, do some birds nest more than once during a season?
Yes, and it's probably more the exception. So probably the more commonly known ones, robins certainly will raise more than one brood, mourning doves. Bluebirds, though, they're not all of them will. Right now I've got bluebirds. The young are about half grown. And I rarely have had bluebirds at my boxes raising more than one family a year. But I'm on the edge of a forested area. This is not the prime habitat. So I think for me, I tend to get the late arrivals, the spillover, and maybe the first-time nesters. So they tend to initiate a little bit later here. I guess when they've run out of all the prime areas, they may find one of my boxes every few years and lucky to raise one family. Mourning doves, I mentioned, they raise more than one. We also have, say, among waterfowl, they will only raise one family, but if there's a loss of the nest, they will try again. So as a ground nester, ducks are certainly very vulnerable. So if they lose that nest, they may lay the eggs another time. Mm-hmm. But the clutch size is always smaller. Since they've used so much energy for the first big production of eggs, if they try again, they're not able to lay quite as many eggs to produce that many. So it's more the exception. And a lot of our long-distance migrant songbirds are single nesters. They'll come all the way up from the tropics, raise one single family, hopefully not have the nest destroyed by predators, not have the young captured as they're just out of the nest and some very vulnerable, and avoid accidents and be able to fly all the way down and for them to survive. So it's a tough world out there, and this is why, as Noel indicated earlier, we do watch our birds just to see how well they're doing from year to year, because essentially there are so many hazards out there in the natural world, and now we as humans have certainly added a lot more into the mix between obstacles for them to negotiate, our communication towers, tall buildings and other structures, introduced predators such as house cats, increased number of predators because we've cleared forests and made an environment more suitable for raccoons and grackles and other natural occurring predators, and of course habitat loss, whether it's here or also down in the tropical wintering grounds. So we've got to keep a watch on them to make sure that when they are trying to raise young, they're successful enough, those survive, and can maintain the population.
As Bill mentioned, that the number of broods that a bird has also varies by where they're nesting geographically. For example, our bluebirds here typically have one or two broods. Three, very rarely. If you had an early spring, maybe like last year, there were probably some bluebirds in Wisconsin that brought off three broods. If you go farther south, you can actually get four broods of bluebirds.
Wow.
Well, all these late nesting attempts by species that only raise one brood are typically because the first nesting attempt was aborted or something happened early in the nesting cycle. Now they will recycle and then try again.
So they're basically trying to make their breeding season a success, whether hopefully it takes one time, but if it takes two, they'll try that.
That's correct.
Ron in Mason has a comment about nesting. Ron,
yes,
welcome
hi.
To the show.
Yes, hi. What I do is I take my vacuum cleaner bag and dump it out on the bushes and my lid from the dryer. And you'd be surprised the number of birds that could use that.
Huh.
Another good recycling suggestion.
Yeah. Right.
Now, is there any concern with, say, you're using, well, most people would be using some kind of detergent in their laundry and maybe even a dryer sheet in the dryer. Is there any concern with any kind of chemical residue that might be on those materials?
I don't think it's a concern, Judith.
Okay. Well, that's great to know. Thanks for that, Ron. And Lynn in Milton emailed, would your guests suggest that when our bluebirds fledge, we remove the nest from the bluebird box, or will the bluebirds use the nest for a second brood?
They will use it a second time, but most recommendations now are now that you can remove the nest. Some people feel in years when blowfly is really bad, it takes a while for predators or parasites of some of these critters to start building up populations, and you may be removing those along with the other. But for the most part, I think bluebird enthusiasts are now recommending that you remove the first nest.
Yeah, it helps in the sanitation of the nest.
Right.
All right. And we did just touch on the fact that there are breeding bird surveys going on. Let's talk about that a little more. Noel, you just spent time in Minnesota working on a Minnesota Bird Breeding Atlas project, now in its third field season. What kind of things do you do when you're doing these surveys?
You try to identify, you're assigned or you select a defined area. Each breeding bird survey atlas block is typically 3 miles on a side, so you're trying to identify every bird in that 9-square-mile area and try to determine what it's doing during your breeding cycle, whether it's just present or singing, defending territory, doing courtship, copulation, like killdeer, doing distraction displays, building nests, carrying food. So you watch the behavior of these various species in this 9-square-mile and document that. And by that way, you can tell a species that's possibly breeding, probably breeding. And, of course, if they're feeding young or carrying nesting material, you know they're nesting, so they're confirmed in that category. And you try to get as many of these species in the confirmed, and if not confirmed, at least in the probable category as possible. And you try to do this over an entire state or province up in Canada. And Wisconsin completed theirs more than 10 years ago, and we're starting to gear up the start of our second Breeding Bird Atlas project here with the field work starting in 2015, so it's not that far off.
So it sounds like it's almost similar in some ways to the census that we do on people.
A little bit, yes. How many are there and what are they doing there?
And, Bill, you said that obviously there's a lot of good information that we get out of these breeding surveys, but there are also some things that we're not getting. Tell us what that is.
Well, you mentioned human census, and this is a point I always like to make, is that there's a real difference between what we call a wildlife survey or bird monitoring compared to a human population census. And what I mean by that is when we're doing a census, we want to count everybody. And even there, we know that there are problems trying to get a hold of every single individual in the country. We've got illegal aliens, felons, and people who have a mistrust of government who don't want to be counted. And here, you can walk up to a door and knock on it and talk to somebody. Birds are hiding out in the wild, and whether that is right in the rough of your backyard, where they're carrying on a kind of secretive life, to some large forested and grassland areas in Wisconsin where they're just hard to observe. So we can never count them all. What we're really doing is sort of keeping our finger on the pulse of the trend of the population. Knowing we can't count them all, what we're trying to find is some sort of a method, as Noel described, some of these for breeding birds or for the breeding bird surveys, where we're just simply watching and listening for birds along a route, and we're just trying to see how many we detect of each kind and do that year after year. And knowing we're not going to get every individual, we do it over enough of a broad area, we're looking for what the trend is. Are we finding more than we did in the past, less, or are they holding their own? And so when you look at bird data, you will never see, say, unless you've got an endangered species where we're down to, let's say, like Puerto Rican parrot, we can count every individual on that little island. We know just how few there are left. But for most birds in North America, we are looking more at the population trend. So we talk about something to the effect of, say, a decline of the population at 2% per year over the last 10 years or 20 years. So we know the rate of decline or increase. We don't know how many we started with. We don't know how many are out there right now, but we know that there's a relative increase or decrease based on our methods. And that's what we're really trying to do, is just sort of watch what's the trend. And with so many different species out there, which ones are hanging in there, which ones are coming back or even increasing and in expanding their range, or which ones are in trouble and which ones are declining and are now the ones that we need to focus some sort of attention and effort on to try to reverse that and keep them from becoming endangered or certainly from going extinct.
And Noel, would you like to add to that?
Well, of course, one of the things it doesn't tell us is why these birds are doing what they're doing. Why are they increasing? Why are they declining? You know, for some, we have a pretty good feel for it. But others, we just have no idea, and it's very often a combination of factors. And of course, that's why we need to study birds if we want to try to improve the status of those that are declining. We need to understand why they are declining and identify what can be done to maybe reverse those trends. And of course, that's where the real rubber hits the road, whether you can do that or not, and you know, how expensive is it, how broad of an area do you have to do that. Maybe it's just happening on the breeding grounds, and we can address that, but maybe it's during migration at all the stopover locations along the way, or maybe it's in the wintering grounds. You know, declines can really kind of target any place along that 365 days a year, and we need to understand where the bottleneck is or where the real critical points are so we can try to address that. And so surveys give us a feeling for what is happening, but it doesn't tell us a whole lot about why it's happening.
The other problem with the surveys is that the best way to detect the birds is to go out, have an experienced birder go out and listen for the birds in a early summer morning. So for Wisconsin, we started breeding bird surveys in the southern part of the state after June 1st, in the northern part of the state after June 15th. And the reason for that is that considering a late year like this, we figure that by the time we're getting into June, all the migrants should be out of the area. So anything that we're hearing or seeing is a local nesting bird. So we go out, we watch for the birds, we listen for all kinds of things that we can hear. Well, it's the males that do the singing, not the females. Just because he's singing doesn't tell us that he's actually going to find a mate, or that even if he does, that that pair is actually successfully going to raise any young. Of course, the kind of indication of all of this or the conclusion would be that if this bird is out there singing over and over again, never finds a mate, never raises young, and eventually perishes, there's nobody to replace himself, and of course, you're not going to hear anybody in following years sometime down the road. So there are biases that way that we detect the presence primarily of the singing males, but we have no indication of nesting success. And to add to that, I get this every year about this time of year as we get into early July. Around my neighborhood, I start hearing males singing that weren't there earlier in the year. In the last 5 days, I've had an oven bird now singing just across the road. He wasn't there before. And these are floaters, probably unsuccessful males that are moving around still trying to look for a mate and haven't found one, or perhaps one that lost a mate, or who knows what the fate is, and is just trying again before the summer's up. And some of these birds may come up here, sing their heart out all summer long and never connect, never be successful, and fly all the way south and come back and try again. And for a lot of these birds, they're actually not real successful nesters until they're at least 2 years old. So they've got to make that route a couple of times before they actually are a little more experienced and can move up that a pecking order and be able to take advantage of...
quite literally more pecking order.
Yeah.
Well, we have lots to talk about with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert about birds and bird watching and listening to birds. And we will do more of that in just a moment. We'll get back to the phones. We'll talk about some buffleheads that are nesting at Horicon. And we'll take a look at a photo that listener Steve posted on Facebook and see what Bill and Noel think that is. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Christy Taylor, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert about birds and bird watching on this Independence Day edition of the Larry Mueller Show. We always appreciate when they spend their holidays with us. And Steve posted a photo on Facebook, says, love your holiday bird shows. He saw this bird on a power line in central North Dakota when they were home for Memorial Day. He thinks it's a yellow legs, greater or lesser. He's not sure. And he's wondering what it is. It's a, definitely a waiting bird. Bill, what do you think?
This is upland sandpiper. Very nice photo, in fact. And it is while it is a sandpiper, it's actually a bird of the prairie lands. This is why I gave the name the upland sandpiper, where we think of sandpipers more in the lowlands, edges of marshes, and mudflats. So here's a bird that he indicated he got it in North Dakota, where he's really in the heart of the range. Associated with the prairies, we had a good population in Wisconsin, and I recall 25 years ago, western Fond du Lac County, we had upland sandpipers you could find there fairly reliably, but this is a population that has declined quite seriously over the years. Looking at our breeding bird atlas for Wisconsin, the real stronghold during the last survey was in the central southwestern part of the state, Lafayette County. They had a number of successful confirmed nest sightings there. The Brown County, Door County, sort of Green Bay, going up into Door County area, and then in the far northwest in some of those barren open areas between the forested areas in far northwest Wisconsin and also west central Wisconsin, we get a few areas where we see upland sandpiper. In Wisconsin, it's a rare sight. You got to kind of hunt around a few of those hot spots or just get lucky to find them. But as you get a little further west, you're getting into the heart of the range. And it's incredible long-distance migrants going from our prairies down to the pampas of South America and Argentina.
Wow.
And it's one of the species that we've just added to the threatened species list here in Wisconsin, showing how it has declined, as Bill mentioned.
Well, thanks for that photo. Let's go back to the phones, and Doug in Madison is next. Hi, Doug.
Oh, hi. A friend of mine and I saw about a month ago a flight of white pelicans, and recently we discovered there's a marsh near Madison where there's dozens of white pelicans nesting. And we were really surprised. The Kaufman guide says they migrate north to Minnesota, but I've never seen them in Wisconsin before. How common is that, and what are they doing here?
And what marsh was that in Madison?
It's just north of Madison.
Okay.
Were they actually nesting there? Did you actually confirm that, or are they just sitting on the water in large flocks?
I think they're nesting. There's a whole bunch of them on one shore, and there's a number of them that are sitting on tree stumps and things in the water. Okay. But they've been there for weeks.
Well, this is one of the species
of white pelicans that hang out, so to speak, in certain favored marshes and shallow lakes. The number of nest sites are slowly increasing. Fact is that myself and Sumner Madison, who is with the Endangered Resources Program with the Department of Natural Resources, he and I are just finishing up a paper on the history of white pelicans in Wisconsin.
Hmm.
When we looked at the historical records, yeah, we've seen white pelicans on and off all throughout the recorded period. We're on the far eastern edge of their range. So white pelicans winter from, say, the Carolinas south across the Gulf Coast, and this is sort of the common area for them to be wintering, and into Mexico. Their nesting range is actually in the Dakotas and going up into central Canada and to the northwest of there. So if you draw a line, say, from Florida to the Dakotas and south-central Manitoba, we're right on the edge of that migration. And it turns out they don't go quite in that line. They come north off the Gulf Coast, hit the Appalachians, go over toward the Mississippi, and then come up and then fan out across the prairie pothole region. So Wisconsin is just off to the edge of that. And we very commonly have had sightings, especially during the spring migration, and occasionally, especially in the 70s and 80s and 90s, of birds remaining here in summer. Those were probably all sightings of non-breeders. Pelicans don't nest until they're at least 5-6 years old.
So they're more adolescents, maybe.
Yeah, adolescents, not in a real rush to go to a breeding ground. They find a suitable area, they hang out, and bird watchers have sighted them. In 1996, something totally changed, and we had the first nest record in the Green Bay area.
94, Bill.
Okay, I thought Tom Erdman said it was 96. Okay, my memory may be failing me.
It was Atlas says 94, so.
Okay. And then 98 was Horicon Marsh when we had the nesting there. And then we had them at Lake Butamore and eventually on the Mississippi River. Interesting, the Mississippi, they had sightings of summering pelicans there for 7 years in a row with no indication of nesting, and then all of a sudden they finally initiated it.
Hmm.
And what we find is they're a colonial nester. So where you find pelicans nesting, you'll have a group of them, anywhere from, say, 20 or 30 up to 500 or 1,000, or out in the Dakotas in the several tens of thousands even.
Wow, that's a lot of big birds.
Yeah, it is. And what's interesting is that as a colonial nester, they're really slow to start a new nesting site. So birds can hang out year after year. They can come back to the same site as adolescents and take advantage of fishing, but to make that first move to initiate nesting is a slow thing. Once they do, it's like a magnet.
Hmm.
All of a sudden, others now, when they become of age, start to come in, and that population can grow tremendously. And an example of that was the Lake Butamore population. If you can picture a little bit, we had a population in Green Bay, then they started at Horicon. The Winnebago chain is right in between, and they bypassed that time and again. In 2004 and 2008, we had flood years at Horicon. They washed out the pelican nests. They did not start a new site. They went to Green Bay and joined others there.
Hmm.
It was in the early 2000s that they finally, a few started nesting on Lake Butamore. They recorded 20 nests. The next year, there were 40 nests. The following year, Horicon got flooded out again. They went there, and it exploded to 1,000 nesting pair.
From 40 to 1,000?
Yeah.
Wow. That's
so
incredible.
Like I say, they're really slow to find that first, to initiate nesting. Once they do, they can easily be joined by others. And so we've seen now since the mid-90s to where we are today, almost 20 years later, the pelicans have established themselves in Wisconsin. We have actually, what's interesting is this is not a instance where we had, like, say, with turkeys or eagles or other species that they were known here in early historic Wisconsin, then declined, and now are back. As far as we know, they never nested in Wisconsin. We have no record of that. And this is a new phenomenon and kind of a range expansion of these prairie birds moving into our state. And they're here to stay now. And they are huge.
Let's try to...
Wingspread.
Oops, sorry about that. I didn't mean to step on your words there. But let's try to get one more call in before the break for news. And let's go to Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Okay, I may be cut off. We have some... large pine trees, kind of a group of them, and there's a lot of raucous crow noise, and a sharp-shinned hawk flew to another deciduous tree, and I got a good view of it, and then it was sitting there for a while, and then it seemed like another sharp-shinned came in and chased it away.
All right. And so you're wondering if that's a usual
yeah.
occurrence?
Is it a territorial thing?
All right. What do you think?
It could very well be, and I'm sure the crows are being attracted by a nesting predator or maybe a roosting predator in your pine trees, which is a common place for, you know, owls to roost or even nest, and, you know, raptors can certainly nest in that kind of a habitat also. If you saw two together of the same species, it could be a couple different things. It could be courtship. It could be territorial defense between two males. So without, more observation and really kind of trying to understand what's going on, it's just hard to tell if you just see one bird chasing another bird what's really happening.
And, Bill, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, only that it's possible it may be the larger cousin of sharpshin, the Cooper's hawk, which is a very common nester these days, a bird that's really recovered quite well throughout the Midwest. And these pine and spruce trees tend to be a pretty common sight for them as a nesting site.
All right. Well, let's...
Yeah, again, like Noel said, a lot of explanations of what the interaction, what the cause may have been.
All right, let's take a quick call from Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I just wanted to share a funny experience that we had on Chambers Island, at our place on Chambers Island. We had brought a vacuum cleaner from the UP in Michigan that had been used on an orange shag rug, and we emptied the lint out into the woods, and it was rainy, and we had a bright blue carpet on the ramp into our dome, and there we got up in the morning, and here were strips of orange lint spread out very carefully, lined up on the blue carpet. And we couldn't figure out what it was, and we brushed them off, and a little while later, they were back, and we finally we figured out what it was a robin was spreading them out to dry in order to use them in the nest.
Oh, so didn't want to put some damp stuffing in the nest, but wanted to make sure it was nice and dry and fluffy. Does that surprise you, Noel?
Not at all, and that's really a neat story, Stella.
Well, thanks
for sharing.
Yeah, thanks for that, Stella. And we have a lot more to talk with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert about coming up after the news. Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Bill Volkert is a naturalist and a retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. They spend pretty much all of their holidays with us. You know, Noel, does your family ever get after you for always having the middle of the day booked up?
Not at all. They're listening. I have a son and two daughters, and I'm sure they're listening. And my daughter in Peru is probably even listening on her laptop, maybe. So
wow.
Who knows where your listeners are?
It's true. And Bill, you don't get any grief either?
No, in fact, it's kind of a highlight for both of us.
Well, I know it's certainly a highlight for me and for our listeners, so we're very glad that you spend the time with us. Coming up after the news, we're going to be taking a look at some more photos that listeners have posted on the Facebook page. Lee posted a woodpecker-like bird that we'll take a look at. And also, we really want to tell that story of the buffleheads nesting at Horicon Marsh, and a photographer had sent Bill some amazing photos. You'll want to check them out. Pretty high cuteness factor with those little ducklings that are getting ready to jump out of the nesting box. That's all coming up after a look at the NPR News here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Coming up today at 2 o'clock on the Ideas Network, Kathleen Dunn talks with Eugene Schulz about his book, The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army. It's his memoir of service in the United States Army in World War II. But for now, we are talking about birds, birds watching, bird listening, and bird appreciation with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Noel is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, always a pleasure.
Same here, Judith.
And Bill Volkert is a naturalist and a retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Bill, thanks again for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, we have lots of people waiting to talk with the two of you, and we have things to look at on the Facebook page. And I want to start out, because I really want to make sure we don't run out of time for this. There are nesting bufflehead ducks at Horicon Marsh, and Bill, a photographer, sent you some amazing photos. We have seven of them up on the Facebook page. Just really adorable pictures of the little buffleheads waiting to jump out of the nesting box and floating and following mom around. Tell us about the buffleheads, Bill.
Well, first of all, I have to give full credit to our good friend Jack Bartholomew for the photography and certainly for his efforts to try to estimate what day they were going to hatch, to set himself up and sit there patiently just waiting for literally that few minutes when the young were jumping out. What really surprised him when he took the photos is as these young came jumping out, among the brood of about a half a dozen young bufflehead chicks, there were four wood ducks. And we do know that wood ducks are what we call dump nesters. In other words, the hens will go to other nests and lay an egg here or there. And there have been instances where we found wood duck nests with 20 and even 30 eggs in it. Now, a lot of those will not be adequately incubated and won't hatch. It's usually the result of a lack of nesting cavities. So if you haven't got enough available cavities, they're trying to find what they can and put them in. It's also a strategy for the wood duck to try to ensure itself that at least some of its young will be raised. In other words, having a large nest box full of 8, 10, 12 eggs can be an all-or-nothing deal. If a raccoon gets in there, it's total loss. So if you plant an egg here or one there, you may have a chance that somebody else will raise one of your own young. What's unusual about it is, first of all, the fact that we even had a bufflehead nesting in Wisconsin, because if you look in the literature, the normal nesting range for this bird is across south-central Canada and going up toward Alaska. They nest in the spruce forests, which is well out of the range of Wisconsin, and especially Horicon Marsh, a southern Wisconsin cattail marsh, to be nesting in a wood duck box. But in 2009, as I was working out on the trails and setting things up for groups, I, on a few occasions, went by one of the wood duck boxes and saw a bufflehead sticking its head out. And they can be somewhat lingering here as migrants, so we can get well into the month of May, and buffleheads will still be hanging out on some of our waters before they head north. Here we were getting into early and mid-May, and there was a male still sitting out there and this female in the box. And anyway, it's kind of a long story, but I was not able to confirm it. I even took one of the eggs that I had there and had all kinds of measurements done on it and checking with other egg collections and even DNA studies done on it. And turned out that the one egg that I was able to find, an unhatched egg, was a wood duck.
Hmm.
So I couldn't confirm in 2009 that buffleheads actually nested. I waited 2 years, and here again, we've had a bufflehead at one of the boxes, and we waited very carefully. And as we checked them, quite surprisingly, in 2011, we had two nesting pair, probably one of the young of this initial nesting effort, and perhaps it was successful. We don't know for sure. And first record that we have since somewhere in the 1850s, the only other nest record for buffleheads in Wisconsin. If anybody, by the way, is interested in the full story, it's in the journal for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and that is online.
Great. And well, I really recommend people take a look at those photos. And you can, you don't have to be a member of Facebook. Just go to search for the Larry Mealer Show on Facebook. That's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And we posted the photos, so you'll be able, anyone can see them. And they really are worth taking a look at. And I actually have audio of what a bufflehead sounds like. So why don't we take a quick listen to that?
Please.
Noel, what stands out to you for that?
Well, ducks are so hard to identify because very many of them are, you know, nonverbal much of the time of the year. I mean, we're used to seeing ducks floating out on the lakes, and they don't sound off very often. So you really have to be in where they're nesting typically or having some kind of interaction to hear them. One thing I would like to add to this, if you'd like to watch Jack perform his program on buffleheads, this is his hours and hours and hours of sitting in a blind documenting this first nesting that Bill described in 2011 at Horicon. I'd like to invite everybody to come to a River Edge Bird Club program on October the 1st, which is held at River Edge Nature Center. You can email me if you need details or the Nature Center. But it's a 7 o'clock program, and as Bill said, Jack Bartholomew is one of Wisconsin's most wonderful bird photographers, and he'll be sharing the story of what he calls bufflehead, our cutest duck nest at Horicon Marsh on October the 1st.
Well, they really are high on the cuteness scale. And let's make a point to mention that again on the Labor Day show, you guys, so people can get that on their calendars.
Sounds good.
But October 1st at 7 o'clock sounds like a great program. Well, let's go back to the phones because we have some folks that have been waiting quite a while. Joanne in Green Bay is up first. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. It was nice hearing about Jack Bartholomew because he also takes good pictures of bluebirds.
Yes, he does.
Yes. I'm the Brown County Coordinator for the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin. And I'm happy to announce that here we are in the middle of the summer, and what started out as kind of a sad situation, the bluebirds, where they're usually, the tree swallows are usually 2 weeks behind the bluebirds returning from migration. The bluebirds were 2 weeks behind the tree swallows. So we got a late start, but they're doing a great job with catching up. The numbers are almost exactly where they were last year at this time. They're starting on their second broods. So I do believe they'll get a very successful second brood. Unfortunately, maybe not a third, but that's okay because they're doing very well. And they were really good at catching up. I think it had something to do with the weather down south, those bad storms that they had in Tennessee, Oklahoma, Kansas. You know, they always have such bad ice storms late in the season in the winter. But they're making a good recovery, and I've seen where the bluebirds have the last maybe 6 years that I belong to the club. They went from 18,000 fledglings to last year, I think it was 35,000, and they were we were number one in the whole country. Nebraska used to be ahead of us, but now Wisconsin is number one with bluebirds, and it's all with the help of all the dedicated people that help and get interested in them and try to help with building boxes and erecting them and keeping numbers, keeping track and monitoring them.
Well, that's great, Joanne, and that's really quite a success story, isn't it, Bill?
Yeah, I'd like to pay thanks to all the members of the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin and others that put boxes out there, because they've had a dramatic impact on the recovery of bluebirds here in the state.
Jim in Lakes.
So what people can do as a concerted effort to really help a species like that responds to nest boxes,
right?
Bring them back. And I should also mention 35,000, that's incredibly successful. That is what we know of that we raised out of the boxes that we monitor. Of course, there's also populations out there of boxes that are unmonitored and not reported and natural cavities. So we have definitely a healthy
sure.
population, but because of that concerted effort, we really turned things around and brought them back. They're just booming out there.
And Jim in Lake City, Minnesota has something to add on bluebirds, too. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I just wanted to say that in Frontenac State Park, just north of Lake City here, there's some volunteers that have been running a bluebird trail for quite a long time, and I guess I'm not sure exceeding 100 houses, and they do send all of their information up to the university and everything. But this spring they had a situation where there's competition from swallows, and they found some swallows that were dead in the box, and the consensus is that since it was early, that they probably from the migration, they were just so run down that they didn't have enough to survive, and maybe their food source was lacking here when they got here as well. I don't know, but they when they cleaned out the nest and everything, the bluebirds went right in, and there wasn't any problems with mortality there. And there is a restoration of prairie grass and everything in the area, and we do have bobolinks in the park now that are nesting as well. But I was talking to Ruth. She's one of the people that's been doing this for years, and she was telling me about this yesterday. And she said that as far as the nests are concerned, that when the nestlings are in there, the parents keep the nests perfectly clean. I mean, they take out all of the poop and everything out of there, and they're perfectly clean when the nestlings are there. But when the fledges get big enough and they want them to leave the nest, they quit cleaning the nest and quit feeding them. So she said, maybe we could learn from that.
So, Noel, what do you think?
Maybe so, but yeah, after a brood has fledged out of a bluebird house, the nest really gets trampled down. It's no longer a cup nest, but just kind of a flat platform of matted grass stems and other vegetative materials, and all the defecation trying to get spattered all over the box. So, as Bill mentioned, that's another reason for removing that first nest is just nest box sanitation. But early season mortality, both bluebirds and tree swallows, is really quite common. But as we've talked about, these birds are really plastic in their ability to rebound, and typically it doesn't cause any long-term mortality to cause a population decrease at all.
Let's go back to the phones and Jack in Madison. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Thank you for a wonderful program. My wife and I live in the west side of Madison, and we had so much fun watching sparrows build a nest in a very secure location on top of a wooden trellis and just below the roof of the garage. So it was a very secure nest, and they had a brood, and we heard them chirping, and the mother and father were going back and forth all the time. We just enjoyed watching them, and then the little fellas got out, and they flew around and didn't go too far from the nest, and then all of a sudden they were gone, and we thought that was over. And then the next thing that happened is I think they had a second brood. Anyway, we heard the chirping again, and the mom and dad were flying back and forth. And then out of nowhere appeared a big blue jay. And then one morning we got up, and I can't emphasize how much this nest was in a secure place. and had gone through many rainstorms, the nest was down on the ground and everybody was gone. Now, would a blue jay have done something to the nest?
That's a good question. Bill?
Yeah, very much preyed on the young. It is a possible food source. Blue jays, crows, grackles are probably among the more common nest predators. They may try to take the eggs when the nest is abandoned temporarily, when the females are away, as a food source, or maybe even grab the young out of there. It's not unusual. So there's a possible mortality there of the eggs and young before they ever get out from other birds, only a few, or occasionally even squirrels. Red squirrels certainly are known as nest predators, and raccoons are probably one of the bigger ones, especially for the larger eggs, such as ducks and pheasants.
And so, Noel, I think of blue jays. I like blue jays a lot, actually, but they're very aggressive, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and as Bill mentioned, they're definitely predators at times, but, you know, it's not a big issue. It's not something that they're spending all their time out there looking for that kind of food item, but they're very opportunistic, and, you know, it's when the birds are really noisy, it draws attention to them in a nest, and, you know, if they can, they will prey upon them, but it's not something where, you know, they're a protected species. Someone shouldn't try to take matters in their own hands and try to shoot them or anything else. It's just part of they're doing what blue jays do.
Part of the
circle
of life.
And I agree with Noel. It's just an opportunity. It's a rare part of the diet. If they get a chance, they find them, they'll grab them, but it's certainly not a major food source for them.
On Facebook, Lee posted a photo. She says, this woodpecker-shaped bird visits feeders and eats suet in northeastern Barron County. He's about the size of a ladderback with no discernible color on its head. She apologizes for the poor photo quality, but she said he's quite skittish, and this was taken with a phone through a window glass. She says there are white patches on the side of his head. Any ideas on what that might be, Bill?
Yeah, it is a very small picture. My best guess from the image I'm seeing is a hairy woodpecker.
A hairy woodpecker.
Which hairy and downy are the two of the more common species of woodpeckers all throughout the state of Wisconsin.
All right. Well, thanks for that photo, Lee.
Yeah.
And I know we always like to include some audio in the show so people can, people like me who aren't very good at being able to discern what bird they're hearing, can kind of fine tune some of those things. So let's take a moment and listen to a couple different thrushes. Bill suggested a wood thrush and a hermit thrush. So let's listen to the hermit thrush first. And actually, let's listen to the wood thrush also, and then maybe Bill and Noel can compare those for us. So that was first a hermit thrush and then a wood thrush. Noel, what stands out to you in those sounds?
Well, I grew up with wood thrushes. So I always think the wood thrush is prettier than a hermit thrush. But other people here in Wisconsin where you can hear both, you only hear hermit thrushes in the northern third of Wisconsin. They do not breed here in the southern two-thirds of the state. And thrushes don't often sing during migration, and they start singing once they get on the breeding ground. So that's kind of one way to separate, but hermit thrushes tend to have kind of, well, relatively long, clear whistled notes that's mostly steady in pitch and then often followed by a rapid series of musical notes. What your listeners should do, if they can, go onto a website and listen to these songs slowed down. And it's just amazing because they're doing duets with themselves. And if you think these songs are beautiful, listening to them at this speed, if they're slowed down to halftime, you'll just throw up your hands and say, how is that possible that they can do this?
Mm. And Bill, what would you add?
Just from what Noel said, slowing them down, there was a fellow, Donald Bohr, who did some of the very early recordings of birds from Ohio State University. He had these things slowed down to quarter and eighth speed. And when they get really slow, It sounds absolutely just alien. It doesn't sound like anything out of this planet, like background music to a sci-fi film. What I noticed between the two, they're very flute-like, very musical, that nice little warble to it. But the Hermit Thrush tends to have that little introductory note, one or two notes, and then you'll have that little warble at the end, where the Wood Thrush, they describe it as an eole, and you'll tend to do one eole a little high, another one ending a little bit low. And it's sort of this little back and forth, nice, soft, and just that great sort of echoing, warbling sound to it. A number of the thrushes have those very flute-like, very echoing calls, as Noel says, so like harmonizing with themselves. And, yeah, it's just incredible music in the woods when you hear it.
Well, we'll try to include some different audio every time that we do a bird show, so hopefully we can all improve our listening and identification abilities. We had a caller earlier who wanted to know how to keep pigeons away from his bird feeder. The mourning doves he's been feeding are suddenly staying away because of those pigeons. Any ideas, Bill?
Pigeons. Well, that's one of the problems when you're feeding birds is you're putting out a diet that, well, if it's seeds, I mean, any of the potential seed eaters can be attracted. And it's a little hard to be selective. And I've had a number of people ask me, how do you keep everybody at the feeder except for grackles or except for starlings or, in this case, pigeons? You could try switching the food source a little bit, especially this time of year when food is so abundant in nature. We're really feeding them more for that convenience and also the interest to bring them close to us. It's certainly not critical to survival. If you want to keep the pigeons away, you may want to switch over to a larger sunflower seed to see if that's something that's a little more difficult for them to handle, or the finer thistle seed, the Niger seed. Change the diet a little bit. Try a little bit of different seed. Usually that cracked corn and millet is something that is kind of a general food that a lot of birds are attracted to. And try to get something in there that's a little harder to handle for the pigeons or other birds that you don't want to attract.
And Noel, certainly last year we were talking a lot about the importance of having water out for our birds because it was so hot and so dry. This year certainly seems pretty different. Is that a general need even when it's a more usual season of rain and precipitation?
Well, they definitely need water, but, you know, with the kind of rain we've been having, there's more puddles around. There's just more available surface water in fields and ditches and so forth. So, you know, the demand isn't at having it at your feeder is not as high, but, you know, it's still there. I still have both in the front yard and the backyard, we have water available to birds. And I don't think you see the crush like we did last summer, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
It's such a dry summer, but they will still visit. One of the things that on the pigeons, you may try to, you know, put a lean-to or prop up a door or something where the, you know, mourning doves will go in underneath that and feed, not real close to the ground, but, you know, a couple feet off the ground where pigeons are less likely to walk in under such a cover for fooding or feeding. So she may want to try to do a little adaptation to her feeder, too, to try to exclude the pigeons.
Well, as always, it's been a lot of fun, and we had much more to talk about than we had time to do it. Bill Volkert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's entirely my pleasure. Thank you, Judith.
And Noel Cutright, as always, a real pleasure.
Yes, and hopefully we can be on Labor Day.
Absolutely. I'm certainly planning on it. Bill, are you good to go for Labor Day?
Oh, you bet.
All right. Well, then we don't have much time to wait until we can talk with Bill and Noel again, which is great. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Christy Taylor was our on-air producer. Thanks to her for a great job. Stay tuned. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn in her new time slot. And tomorrow here at 11, it's time for Garden Talk, and we'll be talking especially about great crops of vegetables. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Have a great holiday.